Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today is a very special episode because it represents our 365th unique interview, meaning that we now have one Crescent Fresh episode for every day of the year, unless we're in a leap year. But don't worry, we'll be taking care of that oversight next week. So for all of you folks who read the Bible or any other holy book cover to cover, chapter by chapter, on a daily basis throughout the year, team our program with your efforts for a wonderful and well-rounded intellectual and spiritual experience. We have been pleased to be on the internet for nearly 8 years now and blessed by a wide range of guests, from philosophers to physics professors and architects to street preachers, and of course, everything in between. And we have another delightful guest today, fresh in from shoveling 6 inches of snow, and that is Professor David Deevil, an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. A lot of saints there. And he is also the editor of the journal Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture. Dr. Deevil is an expert in the thought of G.K. Chesterton, John Henry Newman, and Francis de Sales, among many other great theological thinkers. He also throws in a dollop of discussion on Harry Potter in his scholarship as well. His writings have appeared in various journals, including the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars Quarterly, the Chesterton Review, Faith and Reason, and the Journal of Markets and Morality, among other places. And recently he placed an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal about going to graduate school. So if you are thinking about going to graduate school, it might be worth a look-see. I should also note that Dave also recently had a piece appear in the Proceedings of the 2015 University Faculty for Life Conference entitled Evangelical and Catholic Vampire Hunters, which would be great fodder for our annual Halloween show. And for those of you who are not considering on going to graduate school and instead want to hunt vampires, you should check out that one as well. Today, though, we are going to focus on his work about Francis de Sales and possibly also get in a few words on John Henry Newman and G.K. Chesterton. Of course, you can always find out more about our guests and their writings over at our website, where we have informative and fun-filled links. So please drop by www.researchonreligion.org and say hi. Dave, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, thanks, Tony. I'm glad to be with you.
So you are at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. That has to be a little bit confusing. So how do you remember to put the right saint in the right place on your letterhead and envelopes?
Yeah, it's well, we call University of St. Thomas UST, so we have an initialization for that, and so that helps keep things clear. The original name of the town of St. Paul was actually Pig's Eye, but the Archbishop John Ireland, the first archbishop of this area, convinced the city fathers that St. Paul would be a much more august designation for the city.
I actually think Pig's Eye would be absolutely fantastic. I would lobby for to get that one back. And having grown up in Wisconsin, you know, Minnesota was always our rival, so we always spit in the Pig's Eye. So I think we should name it that.
Well, there is a beer named Pig's Eye, so we still have that going for us.
All right. Well, that's good. Now, you have a very, very interesting scholarly portfolio that includes Chesterton, Newman, Harry Potter, and Dracula. Okay, so how does one go from being an undergraduate student at Calvin College in Michigan, then on to graduate studies at Fordham University, where you wrote a dissertation about eternal damnation in the thought of John Henry Newman, to writing about all these other things? I mean, give us a little bit about your intellectual development, including how you ended up at a Calvinist college and then became a scholar predominantly focused on Catholic thinking and vampires.
Yeah, well, like many Americans, I grew up in a sort of evangelical household. My dad was actually a graduate of Moody Bible Institute. My mom was an old-fashioned Ohio Baptist. But when I was a young child, they began to be looking for something a little more well-rounded in terms of preaching and teaching about the scriptures. So they wandered into the Reformed tradition, the Christian Reformed Church, which is the church denomination, Dutch Calvinists, that has Calvin College. So as I was growing up, I was going to church in this Calvinist environment, but it was in South Bend, Indiana, where the University of Notre Dame is. And so we had a lot of Protestant professors from Notre Dame at my church, including the philosopher Alvin Plantinga and the historian, medieval historian John Binning. And so I was around this sort of, you know, close to Catholic environment, but in the Reformed tradition. And I was interested in theological, literary matters, and philosophical matters. And I decided to go to the denominational college, Calvin, up the road. And there I got a really good liberal arts education and Christian education. And while I was there, I studied English literature and philosophy formally. I had minors, or almost minors, in French and theology. And I did a semester in Oxford at the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies, where I, you know, tooled around the places where C.S. Lewis and John Henry Newman and all of these famous figures were. And I started to grapple with certain theological questions. And so after I graduated in 1996 from Calvin, I ended up becoming a Catholic in 1997, and I decided to go to graduate school because my issues were theological. But from there, I continued to read literature and history and philosophy, and I've kind of kept to that pattern of trying to be a truly liberally educated person and writing on things that I think are interesting and trying to develop an acquaintance with them. So it looks like my CV looks like kind of a hodgepodge of things, and it probably is, but I've decided that I'm going to write about the things that I'm interested in and see if people will take them. And thus far, I've had a number of pieces accepted. So
very cool. As a realtor would say, it's location, location, location.
That's
growing
right.
up Protestant next to Notre Dame made you who
right.
you were. So now you kind of explained the Catholic stuff, but the vampires, I mean, come on, how did you get into this vampire stuff?
Well, I mean, as I said, literature was always interesting to me. And even as a teenager, I discovered these, you know, sort of Southern Gothic writers like Flannery O'Connor, the great Catholic figure, and Walker Percy, another writer, who both wrote about kind of off-kilter topics, and they saw the world, the modern world, as being mixed up. And so I was always interested in these topics of the Gothic and the sort of the strange. And so I've been reading a number of these things, and a few years ago I was reading Dracula, and it struck me that what we have here is sort of a perfect analogy for our time. Dracula is this kind of oversexed monster who lives off of the blood of other people. And it looked to me like what Pope John Paul called a culture of death. And on the other side, those vampire hunters were a kind of ecumenical grab bag of pious Anglicans and Bram Stoker, who Bram Stoker's novel, the character Abraham Van Helsing, is a kind of Catholic theologian / natural scientist. And it struck me that that's kind of like the Evangelicals and Catholics Together movement, which united to fight forces that were trying to destroy nature and supernature altogether. So that's kind of how I came to the topic.
It actually sounds really fun, and so we're going to have to keep that in mind possibly for our Halloween show here in the future. But we're here today to talk about a recent article. It's actually a couple years old now, but you just uploaded it on academia.edu, which is how it caught my attention. The article that I am talking about here is entitled Francis de Sales, a Patron Saint for Our Age. Now, most folks, when they hear the word Saint Francis, immediately think about Francis of Assisi, that guy who founded Ye Olde Franciscans. But as many folks know, there's a lot of saints out there, and it's not a wonder that there would be more than one Francis. So how did you stumble upon this guy, and why should we know more about him?
Well, I kind of did it as a Protestant too, but as a Catholic, I took up the practice of doing spiritual reading, and I was particularly interested in many of the lives of the saints. And one of the things that people told me I had to read was the Introduction to the Devout Life by this Francis. And I read it, and I found that it was utterly gentle and sustaining and yet tough in the same way. He wanted people to be tough on sin, but also gentle with themselves. And I found him to be utterly likable. And as I read more of him, particularly his Catholic controversies, his sort of interdenominational polemics, if you will, against the Protestants of his day. He was born in 1567, so a few years after the Council of Trent, and well into the time of the Protestant Reformation movement. I found that he was not only agreeing with things that I said in these controversies, but he had a deep and wise spirituality, and his history sort of bore that out. He was in a tumultuous era, and he was a Swiss man, but he was not what we think of the Swiss today as neutral. He was very solidly in favor of the Catholic side in the Reformation, but as he started his priestly ministry as a young man, he realized that what he needed to do was not only to counter what he saw as wrong arguments on the parts of many of the Swiss Calvinists, but he also needed to exercise a ministry of friendship to them and to share gifts with them. So, his life as well as his spirituality embodied this sort of toughness that was ultimately embodied in love. So that's kind of what drew me to him, was a spiritual voice about whose life then I found basically the same qualities that attracted to me in his writing.
So you already gave an indication when this guy was around, because I'm sure many people are thinking St. Francis de Sales. And am I pronouncing it right, de Sales?
I say de Sales, but de Sales. I'm an Indiana boy. So.
Okay. Well, yeah,
technically, I think French it would be de Sales. So,
okay.
But, you know, we can say it however we want.
Yeah, that's right. What's he going to do? He's not around to complain about it.
He won't be mad.
That's right. And this whole love thing and loving stuff, it sounds like he's a pretty easygoing guy. But he grew up in a very difficult era. And I think most people, if they heard St. Francis de Sales, they would go, well, okay, he probably lives somewhere between, I don't know, 33 AD and now. So, you indicate that he was born, actually in the article it says he was born just a few minutes after the end of the Council of Trent. So
yeah,
that is kind of interesting.
I think I said 7 years. I looked back at my article before the interview and I realized I said seven, but the council actually ended in 1564. So about a little over 3 years after the council ended, but
okay.
Right in that period of time when things had kind of solidified and the sides had started to set up. I mean, if you remember, Calvin's Institutes were published in that period right before in several different editions. So people were starting to take sides, and now there was this sort of, well, there are Lutherans, and there are Calvinists, and there are these Anabaptists and the Catholics. And so it was very difficult because there was a lot of tension. And some of it was political, but I think, modern interpretations that it was all political just fail because people really believed that there were things at stake about these theological positions. And Francis did, too. Like I said, he's not our modern notion of an ecumenist who sort of splits the difference. He took the side of the Catholics, but he also understood the people that he was dealing with and knew that it wasn't just arguments alone, but it was going to be the witness of a person who was like Christ that was going to show them what he thought they needed to know.
So give us a little bit more about this guy, where he grew up, and was he a parish priest? Was he a theologian? What did he do in his youth?
Well, he went to college, and he first, like many foolish young people, you mentioned my article on going to graduate school. A friend of mine said that he often talks to people about going to law school and discourages them. Yeah. Francis went to law school first, but he felt that he wanted to serve God, and so he did a lot of prayer. He did a lot of fasting. He did a lot of study. And he said, Lord, what do you want to make of me? And at one point he said, I had this desire, and my prayer was, Lord, let me see theology. And what he meant by that was not some sort of abstract, system, but instead he wanted to know concretely what the Lord wanted of him. And he discerned that the Lord wanted him to become a priest, and so he did. He was in the Savoy region, a sort of, the beautiful Swiss area. He was a young hunter and person who loved to go out in boats. Some people have joked that, these different saints are known as things. Augustine is known as the Doctor of Grace. They said he would be the Doctor of Rowing. But he was kind of a good old boy, but he wanted to see theology. He wanted to know what the Lord wanted of him, And so he became a priest, and he went back to that area of Switzerland where the Calvinist church had basically solidified. And he decided that he was going to minister to these people, and it had to be a kind of undercover ministry. So he exercised, you know, certainly it wasn't your ordinary parish priesthood. It was something more like a secret agent kind of thing. And by the, after a number of years, he was made the bishop of the area, the bishop of Geneva, which was, of course, where John Calvin was. And he exercised the same sort of ministry of, you know, logical argument, as in his writings called the Catholic Controversies, but also a real love and a relationship with the people around him. And he largely turned that area back to the Catholic side during his lifetime. So he exercised an incredible local ministry and refused, in fact, to be promoted higher up by people who thought, oh, well, this guy's smart, and he did write some theology on the side. We should make him the Archbishop of Paris or something important. And he said, no, I want to stay. The Lord has placed me here. I want to minister to these people. You know, they have souls, too. So it's a really quite remarkable story of a man who, you know, in certain ways, what we would say in modern lingo, you know, believed in localism, that he was placed by God in his location, and God wanted him to serve there.
So you said that he has this kind of secret agent ministry. Well, that's going to be revealed when you're appointed to the Bishop of Geneva. That's right. You get a big hat.
That ended when he was publicly made the bishop there. But during his priesthood, at one point, you know, he was interreligious dialogue at that time, ecumenical dialogue, was not so nice and easy as it is now, but he was being trailed by people, and he had to hide in a tree for like 12 hours in order to be undetected. So that had to go by the wayside once he was officially the bishop of the area.
Oh, my gosh, hiding in a tree. In terms of the secret ministry, was it just kind of house to house or kind of,
right,
as we say, catacomb to catacomb back in the early days of Christianity?
That's right. He went into the area. Like I said, he didn't wear any special clothing or any I'm a priest badges. And he would find local families that were still on the Catholic side, and he would minister to them, and he would try to make friends then with other people in the area, and not immediately challenge them on theological points, but instead to get to know them, and then very gradually reveal his secret identity, if you will, when he felt that they were ready to find out about that and that they were open to it and at least not going to chase him into a tree.
Yeah, that actually fits with a lot of our social scientific understanding of how conversions happen. It's not a lightning bolt per se coming down, although that has happened on occasion, but it's friends and family, network.
That's
conversions.
Right.
You say, hey, I got this in common with you and that in common. I like to row. Do you like to row? Yeah, let's go out.
That's
rowing.
Right.
And eventually you say, oh, yeah, not only do I like to row, but I got this Catholic thing going for me, which is kind of interesting. Did he ever actually run across Calvin or end up debating Calvin at the time?
Well,
I'm not sure how contemporary.
In my study, I've not been able to find that he actually knew Calvin, but they were supposedly at university in the same time. And but I don't find any evidence that they concretely knew each other. It's quite possible that they ran across each other in Paris at one point. But Calvin was a very old man by that time, so I don't think he ever really made any contact.
So he is a saint, because he is Saint Francis de Sales.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he get sainthood? I could imagine that hiding in a tree for 12 hours was probably one of the miracles that counted for him. But how did he get sainthood, and when did he get sainthood?
Well, it was not that long. He's not one of the super modern saints. Some of the English saints, like Saint Thomas More, was not made a saint until the 20th century. In part, I think, because of worries about persecution that were in England. But Francis was recognized within the 17th century, and I can't remember what miracles were attributed to him. Usually, in the Catholic process of recognizing a person as a saint, which is to say, not that everything they did was great, but that they did end in friendship with God and that they are in heaven. There were a number of miracles that were attributed to him. He also founded an order of nuns. He helped with the Visitation Order, and there was an order known as the Salesians that followed after him that are dedicated to his dedicated to his thought and to his ministry. That's quite often in the Catholic Church how things work. If you have an order that's dedicated to you, or that you have founded, they will be very insistent on trying to figure out whether you were a saint or not, because they have kind of skin in the game in terms of letting people know that our ministry is valid, and we are authentic witnesses to this saint's life. So,
well, one of the guys who was a big fan of him was Saint Vincent de Paul, and I know him a little bit more because he opened a series of Goodwill stores or like that. Now that you mentioned the Salesians, though, I go, oh, of course, I know the Salesians. It came from this guy. So
I guess
I wasn't paying attention, you know, on that day in my Saints class at Marquette. But Saint Vincent de Paul really loved this guy. In your article, you quote him as saying this: Monsignor de Sales ardently wished to imitate the Son of God. So closely did he model his life on our Lord, as I myself saw, that many a time I asked myself with astonishment how a mere creature could reach so high a degree of perfection, given human frailty. Recalling and meditating on his words, I felt them to be so admirable that I could only see in him the person who most nearly reproduced the Son of God living on earth. Unquote. That's pretty tall order there. This guy must be pretty good. So why did Saint Vincent de Paul love this guy so much, and what was his approach to theology that really earned him that kind of respect?
Well, I think it was twofold. He had this ministry, and he was well known for his defense of the faith. Like I said, he wrote those Catholic controversies, but he also then wrote these treatises, which were meant not to argue with Protestants or argue with anybody else, but simply to open up what it means to be a Christian. And his Introduction to the Devout Life is something that has been sold. It's been incredibly popular. He also wrote other books on the love of God, two volumes on that, and they're a little more technical. When he studied for the priesthood, he studied all the theology of the day that he could find, and he read up not only on St. Augustine, but on St. Thomas Aquinas, and on the Jesuit theologians of the day, Luis de Molina. He knew all of these figures, and he tried to put things together in such a fashion that it fit with what the serious technical scholastic theologians were doing, but also had a touch on people's lives. And many of the things that were passed on were not necessarily the treatises, but also the letters that he wrote. In the midst of all of this work, he had a number of letters that he wrote to countless priests, nuns, lay people, and some of them have been collected in English. But they're all about being like Christ. And so that's why what I think Vincent de Paul saw in him was somebody who could do the theology and the abstract stuff, but who saw that the theology was, again, directed at a real encounter with a living person.
How old did this guy live to? Because he's, as you talk about him now, he's written a lot of stuff. And I have a word processor on my desktop here, and I haven't written that much stuff. And they were dealing with, you know, the quill pens at the time. So how old did this guy live to?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember how old he lived to be. He started in 1567, and he lived well into the 16th century. I think he was about 70 when he died. I think he was about 70, 71 or 72, if I can remember correctly. He lived to be a good old man for those times. He was a bishop for at least 25 years in Geneva. So, and that was after this long ministry as a young man, starting in the 1590s.
Now, one of the frameworks for your article here, you do a really nice job of detailing the life and times of Francis de Sales, but you also say that he is a patron saint of our age. And what do you mean by that?
Well, like I said at the beginning, he was born into a time of a lot of strife, and he met that strife not simply by declaring a side and then condemning the other side, which is what a lot of people do. We have all of this polarization in the modern world and even here in America. And he responded to that not by splitting truth down the middle. He was attached to truth, But he was also aware that the way that people come to truth is in this way that you described, that, you know, that social scientists of religious conversion understand, which is that they take things in not simply by looking at a set of abstract logical principles or biblical proof texts or anything like that, but they look at a person to see whether their testimony is true. And so for me, that connection that he has of truth to a person, that clarity that he expressed in his argument, and that gentleness, all in the service of trying to do what Jesus wanted him to do and to be even be like Jesus, really make him, for me, a perfect model for what we have now. You know, he released these little leaflets, the Catholic Controversies. Now, it's not quite as quick as Twitter, but there were, you know, pamphlets were flying around, and many historians of the Reformation say, you know, that's how the Protestant movement got going, was that Martin Luther and a number of others used this new technology and used an appeal to, in the vernacular languages, to get people talking about issues. And Francis did that as well. He wasn't quite the first blogger or anything like that, but he wrote not in Latin, but he wrote in the French of the region. He wrote to people in their own language, and he wrote with clarity and gentleness.
Yeah, I mean, he really picked up, I think, you know, some of the tactics or strategies of social movements at that time and used them in such a way to his advantage. But also, as you say, he didn't get combative with these things. And I think that is something really important to learn. As you mentioned, today for our age, we seem to be very divided. And I know people often say, I've never seen so much polarization, you know, right, in our political system. And I just want to stop and say, oh, really? Let's go back in history. You know, take a dart and throw it at any historical timeline. I will show you that we've kind of had these problems over and over again. And during the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, everything, there was quite a bit of violence. It led some wars and stuff. So it is kind of important that we do take these lessons to account, that one, kindness and gentleness and living a Christ-like life is actually a good way of reaching people, not through in-your-face strategies, but also that, you know, we think our times are unique, but no, we've seen this stuff before, and we can
That's
learn
right.
from
Nothing
that.
Nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, the Ecclesiastes 1:9.
Right.
One of the things at the end that you talk about, and you kind of leave this hanging, it's a little bit mysterious here at the end of your article. You say, one of the more amusing just-so stories that we tell ourselves is that the newness of the Second Vatican Council consists in its declaration that all who are baptized are called to holiness, that all are baptized have a vocation. Explain what you mean by that and put that in reference here to what you're talking about, DeSales.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain narrative, you know, this is kind of, you know, inside baseball on the Catholic side that I was referring to, but there's a certain narrative that even many people that I love and respect have, which is that only with the Second Vatican Council was there an acknowledgement that every Christian had to be holy. And I think that it's a misunderstanding that there was more attention to lay people in certain of the documents of the Second Vatican Council, which happened from 1962 to 1965, but this emphasis on every single Christian being holy was not something that, you know, came up in the 20th century for Catholics, or that they had to import from, you know, from Protestants or anything like that. Francis de Sales was talking about this in his age, starting in the 1590s, that every single Christian is called to serve the Lord with heart, soul, mind, and strength. And he was responding to something that is certainly true, that in the Catholic Church, as well as in, I think, all Christians have had this tendency. There is a sense that, you know, you end up with sort of first-class Christians and second-class Christians. Whether, you know, in my mom's Baptist age, it was those who had gone into the ministry and those who hadn't. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency in Catholic circles to do the same thing. Well, you know, priests and nuns and monks, those are the real sort of the real religious players, and they're the ones who really have to be holy. And I just have to kind of pay, pray, and obey. And I think that that's just a consistent temptation throughout life, that there is always going to be a group of people who will take what they've been given in Christian faith and say, well, you know, this is kind of hard. Let's leave it to somebody else. Francis said, no, there's no possibility of doing that. And he simply made a lot of made a lot of claims to people that, no, you have to be as holy as anybody else. Just because you're not a monk, you know, praying, you know, seven times a day in this official, liturgy of the hours, doesn't mean that you're not supposed to be continually praying, as St. Paul said. He wrote in one of his works that it's an error, or rather a heresy, to wish to banish the devout life from the regiment of soldiers, the mechanic shop, the court of princes, or the home of married people. And he said, look, everybody is called to the same life of intimacy with the Lord Jesus. And I think that that's something that has been there, and he gives us a witness that, no, it's not something that was discovered, you know, just in our time. You know, just as with the problems of our time, those aren't new. The solutions aren't terribly new either. And they've been around with us for as long as Christian faith was there, that everybody should be called to a life of holiness.
Now, this is pretty important for our understanding today, and that's one of the nice things about the saints, is that they represent different characteristics that we would like to mimic or to bring into our own life. But in terms of Francis de Sales' time, did he have a big impact after his death? Was he a largely forgotten fellow and had to be dug up again by somebody, writing out there in St. Paul, Minnesota?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that his spiritual writings, the Introduction to the Devout Life, the various collections of letters that I've mentioned, those things had a big impact. Some of his more technical theological works, and even some of the Catholic controversial writings, you know, kind of lost some of their flavor at certain points for people. But his spiritual writing and that pastoral wisdom has been something that has been passed down pretty much through, you know, since his death. And since he was, since there was an order of Salesians and there were the visitation order, which was, as I said, he had a kind of hand in that through his friend Saint Jane de Chantal. These two orders have been dedicated to his teaching, so they've brought a lot of that down throughout the ages. Now, those orders today are not as strong as they once were, but nevertheless, his influence, I think, has continued in French, certainly, but also in the English language and many other languages as well.
One of the things you do in this article is you blend some of your other research in on this, and you reflect upon the importance of sainthood. And we've had a few guests on our show talk about saints and why they are important. And you cite here G.K. Chesterton in his book on Thomas Aquinas about saints, and he says, quote, "The saint is a medicine because he is an antidote. Indeed, that is why the saint is often a martyr. He is mistaken for a poison because he is an antidote. He will generally be found restoring the world to sanity by exaggerating whatever the world neglects, which is by no means the same element in every age. Yet each generation seeks its saint by instinct, and he is not what the people want, but rather what the people need. Therefore, it is a paradox of history that each generation is converted by the saint who contradicts it the most." How does that all wrap into De Sales?
Well, I mean, look, as I said, he was coming of age in an era of a lot of strife. And Paris, remember that in Paris, there was a large Protestant community, these Huguenots, or Huguenots, as we might say, and there was a lot of strife. We had massacres that occurred by the French king, and then there was fighting back and forth, and there was a lot of this loud talk. Theological dialogue in the late Middle Ages and early modernity makes us look not very exciting. They they really threw things out there. You know, you can look on sites like the Martin Luther insult generator on the internet to find that, you know, Luther had this sort of ability to be scatological. Well, a lot of these theologians did, and a lot of these pastoral figures did. Again, Francis was clear, and people might have wanted somebody to be on our side and to stick it to them and be just as scatological as Luther was. But Francis really resisted that, and he wanted people to be gentle with each other and gentle with themselves, because his point was that, and I think it's something that came to him through reading all of this theology and all this writing of the fathers of the church, that the Lord wants us to have peace, And it's his peace that he gives us in order that we can then calmly defeat the powers of darkness in our own lives. And when we win our own war to be faithful to Christ, then other people are going to see that and attach themselves to us. Again, that's what St. Vincent de Paul said about Francis, was that he really resembled our Lord. And so I think that's how he was an antidote. And that's what we need today, is people who are very clear. We have an age in which we have a lot of yelling and very little clarity. And he was both clear and calm. And that may not be what people are clamoring for, but in the end, that's what's going to speak to the hearts of people who are looking.
It's not what we want, it is what we need, as G.K. Chesterton has said. And speaking of G.K. Chesterton, you've written a great deal about him and another great Catholic thinker, John Henry Newman. But before we dig into those folks, I have to thank you for mentioning the Martin Luther insult generator on the internet, because I think I'm going to put a link up to that now.
Yeah. It's actually... There's also a Pope Francis insult generator now, too. So you can, we can all be happy with the with our favorite theologians who have a turn for the scatological.
So. Yeah, okay. I'm going to have to link both of those in an ecumenical fashion, because I do go to the Martin Luther one, and I'll pull up quotes every so often and paste them against these like beautiful New Age scenery kind of things. And it's kind of funny to put that juxtaposition there. But juxtaposition, speaking of that kind of thing, we have some interesting characters in the 20th century who are great Catholic theologians, not necessarily priests. Some of them are converts. G.K. Chesterton and John Henry Newman. Why are these two folks so important in your understanding of faith? Why have you written on them so much? And what do they add to the conversation about how we live our lives in a daily manner?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I discovered them in part. I discovered Chesterton when I was a teenager and I had come to love C.S. Lewis. And he said of Chesterton that, you know, an honest, a thoroughgoing atheist needs to be very careful about his reading. Because when Lewis was still in his atheist period, he had begun to read Chesterton's great apologetic, The Everlasting Man, as well as other works. And it had shown him that Christian orthodoxy was sane and that it was also freeing. Because in that time, as well as ours, the idea was that if you believed what historic Christian teachings said, that you were imprisoned. And Chesterton opened windows for people by saying, no, it's only the fact that you can rest on a dogma that is true and that opens the world to you that you can really become free. And that really captivated me. And reading him led me then to John Henry Newman, who he resembles in many ways intellectually, if not stylistically. Newman was born in 1801 and died in 1890, and he was himself an Anglican convert, but he became a priest and lived to be the age of 89. But he had that same understanding that Christian truth frees people, and that dogma is, as you might say, man's best friend. And that was something that to me was very, very exciting. And it led me to look at them. In many ways, they make a very similar apologetic. Again, not simply resting on logical, abstract arguments, but arguing for their position on the basis of their entire view of the world. Chesterton says in Orthodoxy that, why do I believe in the creed? It's for the same reason that anybody who doesn't believe in it doesn't believe. And that is on the basis of everything that I see. It interprets the world for me, Christian truth does. So for those two, I think they offer a model of thinking and a model of personal witness that is incredibly appealing, because they are both, I think, going to be saints at some point. Newman is quite close. He's Blessed Newman right now,
okay.
And the Vatican office is investigating a miracle for him. Chesterton, the investigation has just begun, so we're not quite at that stage.
This is the Newman that is named, or has the Newman Centers named after him around campuses, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
So lead us through a little bit of this guy's life, because I see these around, and I think the fact that there's still a Newman Center around the University of Washington, you know, we're the basically the heart of darkness of religiosity because we don't have any
right.
here. That should
yeah,
count
well,
as
Newman
a miracle.
Was born in 1801 around London, and he grew up. He had a kind of conversion at the age of 16. When he was given books by his schoolmaster, a sort of Calvinist Anglican clergyman named Walter Mayers. And he read some of these works, and he suddenly had what he calls the impression of dogma put onto him. So it's, you know, it's not exactly a kind of evangelicalish conversion, but instead it was a very sort of dogmatic conversion, but it was personal nonetheless. And he said, you know, I had the sense that there were, at the time, that there were only two and two alone luminous characters, myself and my creator. So he had that sense, I think, that Francis de Sales had and others, that the Lord is present right to you right now. And he considered, like Francis, studying law, but he ended up becoming an Anglican clergyman in the early 1820s. And he read a lot, and he was discerning what it is that he should be doing, and he felt that the Lord wanted him to sort of return the Church of England to its pure ancient state, that it would be more Catholic but not necessarily Roman. And so his ministry in the 1830s and early 1840s was precisely that. Like Francis, he published a lot of tracts, and that's why he came to be known as one of the leaders of the Tractarian movement or Oxford movement, you know, trying to get the Church of England to be more Catholic. At a certain point in that process, he began to suspect that the principles that he was preaching and teaching were going to lead him to become a Roman Catholic. And so he was working on these issues throughout the 1840s, and he ended up basically asking the question, well, how is it that doctrine develops? Because in the New Testament, we have all of these things that are said, but there's not a lot of clarity. Do we baptize babies? Do we not baptize babies? You can kind of make an argument for both sides. We don't really have the term the Trinity. We don't have all of these things. And yet, we all tend to read Scripture and to see it as developing into a fuller teaching. And so he wrote a book called An Essay on the Development of Doctrine in 1845, in which he proposed a theory of how it is that this Holy Spirit brings about a fuller understanding of the truth and develops that into teachings and practices. And he felt that the Catholic Church was the one which embodied this principle, that it was the church that Christ intended. So he became a Catholic, and then for half of his life, in 1801 to 1845, he was a Protestant, and from 1845 till 1890, he was a Catholic, split right down the middle. And in that second half of life, he ended up founding a religious group called the Oratorians in England, based on another 16th and 17th century figure named St. Philip Neri. And he also did a lot of work on education, and he was asked to be the first rector of a Catholic university in Ireland, in Dublin, Ireland. And that venture didn't quite work out, but what came out of it were a series of lectures and articles that he did on education called The Idea of a University. And that they outlined what a university was supposed to be. It was supposed to be an institution that taught universal truth, as the universe part in university indicates, and that included theology. But it was a vision of education that was holistic, included all angles. It was a true liberal education, and it was to be accompanied by human formation on the side. And so that teaching is what led many people to then name their Catholic ministries Newman Centers. He continued his ministry. He wrote many important books. He wrote a famous poem called The Dream of Gerontius, which was turned into an oratorio by Sir Edward Elgar in the early 20th century. And he wrote a lot on the topic of how is it that I can believe things that I don't quite understand and that I can't defend as well. That was in a book called An Essay on the Grammar of Assent. And so he continued his ministry, and he lived to be an old man, and he died at the age of 89 in 1890. And he was, at that point, loved by all of England, Catholic and Protestant, and people all around the world.
Yeah, fascinating kind of stuff. And G.K. Chesterton kind of follows in here on your reasoning. You kind of see a direct line between these two individuals. So give us a sense of who G.K. Chesterton is and how he kind of follows in those footsteps.
So Chesterton was born in 1874 while Newman was still alive. His parents were kind of Unitarians, and so he wasn't raised in a very strict religious environment. But by the time he reached adulthood, around 1900, he was suspecting that his own view of the world was leading him to be a Christian. And he met a number of important people, including his future wife, Frances Blogg, and Hilaire Belloc, who's a famous English historian and poet. Many people know him for his sort of humorous poetry. And they, along with a number of others, convinced him to take Christian faith seriously. And so he ended up writing about his views of Christianity and why it made sense of the world in 1908 in a book called Orthodoxy. And that book, which he called a slovenly autobiography, fell right into Newman's own sort of line of reasoning. It was about how you could understand the truth of Christian faith without necessarily defending it in this logical, abstract way, but instead by looking at everything around it and making a decision and reasoning as a human being did. He had that sort of personal emphasis, that emphasis on the person thinking as a whole person, the same one that Newman did. And like Newman, eventually he became a Roman Catholic. He believed that there was a church that Christ had founded and that it was the one centered around the Bishop of Rome. And so in 1922, he became a Catholic, and he worked to help people understand, again, how you could look at the world as a whole and see that Christian faith lit it all up and how it made sense in that orbit. So he died. He did not live as long as Newman did. He did quite a bit more drinking, and he was also a pretty heavy smoker. So he died in 1936. But his works are numberless. There's a collected works that's been published by Ignatius Press, and I think they're up to something like 40 volumes at this point. So he wrote numberless books, articles, and essays. And he was a journalist. Unlike Newman, he was not a priest. He was a journalist, one who was happy on Fleet Street, in the heart of the journalism sector in London, and he was also, beloved by people because he wrote ordinary columns and he wrote poetry and nonsense things that people could love, and they trusted him as well.
Mm-hmm. And I can see how this would also just lead into their study of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien as well. They just seem to be birds of a feather in many ways around that time.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Tolkien. There are important arguments about how Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is based thematically and structurally, in a way, on Chesterton's poem, The Ballad of the White Horse, which was all about the defeating of the Vikings by King Alfred, in the ninth century. And I think there's something to them. Tolkien took from Chesterton this sense that the world was aglow with the Lord's providence. And that was something that, again, they both shared with Newman. Newman said that there's one momentous doctrine which enters into all my reasoning, and that's God's providence, which operates the world and keeps things running.
Now, speaking of making odd connections between things, you actually wrote an article comparing and contrasting Chesterton with Hitchcock. And I have not read that article yet. I only saw the title of it. Are you talking Alfred Hitchcock here?
Alfred Hitchcock, yes.
Oh my gosh, tell us about that.
The guy who brought you Vertigo and Psycho and all of those movies, yeah.
So explain what that is about for us.
Well, it's interesting. Hitchcock was himself British. He came to the U.S. in about 1940 to begin, to work in Hollywood. But he was actually a Catholic who was raised, and he was influenced by Chesterton at a number of points. Chesterton defended ordinary literature because Chesterton defended the ordinary person, the common man, and he had a defense of penny dreadfuls, which were the sort of rollicking adventure stories of the day, and people said, oh, well, they're leading to violence and crime. Chesterton said, no, these stories are all what we all live for. Everybody can live without literature, but we cannot live without stories. And Hitchcock saw that, and he was influenced by a number of Chesterton's stories and his novels. And so what I looked at in that article on Chesterton and Hitchcock is the fact that both of them explored in different ways the sense that we have in the world that there is this sort of indeterminacy. In Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday, which he wrote the same year he wrote Orthodoxy, Chesterton talks, has his character Gabriel Syme wonder if there was any floor to the universe. In other words, is anything solid? And that was what Hitchcock was often exploring in many of these suspense movies, was this worry that nothing made sense. You know, Hitchcock had a number of films with the wrong man sort of scenario, in which somebody is, by a series of coincidences, brought into this thing that's beyond him, and he's accused of a crime, or he's involved in a plot, and he begins to doubt whether the world makes any sense. That's also seen in his movie The Birds, where you know, this flock of birds starts attacking, you know, this town in California. And what I noticed in there was that Hitchcock really followed on Chesterton's lead there, and they had this same sense of this indeterminacy. Chesterton, though, on the one hand, was just as keen on depicting that, but he was also keen on showing people that is the way the world works. But if you turn the world on its head and look at it from a certain angle, and he meant certainly from the Christian angle, you would see that what seemed crazy on one side really did have a meaning. That, you know, we were all looking, as it were, on the backside of a tapestry, and we can't figure out what's going on. But if you turn your vision slightly, you'll see that everything does have a purpose, that providence does rule. Hitchcock has that in some of his movies. I don't know if you've seen The Trouble with Harry. It's a very Chestertonian movie in which there are a series of supposed murders, and it turns out at the end of the movie that nobody's murdered anybody. It's a very Chestertonian thing. The later Hitchcock movies, on the other hand, do seem to go in the direction of chaos. And my argument was in part that's in certain ways reflected Hitchcock's own life. His moral and spiritual life was not the consistent one that Chesterton's was. But, you know, there is good news that he did actually come back to faith at the end of his life. There was a great piece in the Wall Street Journal a number of years ago by a priest named Father Mark Henninger, who talked about how when he was in California in the early 1980s, he was sent for to go and minister to Hitchcock. So my article is in certain ways looking at these commonalities and looking where things broke off. And part of my argument was, well, an artist's vision is going to determine in certain ways how he tells the story. And as Hitchcock's moral and spiritual life kind of wobbled a little bit, he was telling different and darker stories. Chesterton can tell those darker stories, but he always managed to flip them on top. And I think that's because he never lost his spiritual balance, as it were.
Well, there you have it, folks. Our 365th episode, we go from everything from a Catholic priest who is a secret agent during the Protestant Reformation, all the way up to Alfred Hitchcock and the Birds, all in one big, huge, wrapped-up bundle here. So, fascinating conversation. But I want to finish off with some reflections that you have. You're still pretty young in your career, not a gray-haired like I am now. But you've actually done quite a bit of reading and a lot of reflection, I can tell, from how you really understand these different authors, these different historical figures. But is there anything that you have learned along the way that may have surprised you? So if you could, at some point in time, take a journey back to David Deville, back when he was maybe, I don't know, 18, 19, 20 years old, and say, hey, you're not going to believe this happens along the way, but here it is. What would you say?
Well, I mean, in many ways, that was in part when I became a Catholic, when I was 23, that was a kind of flip. Because although I was attracted to many Catholic authors and many Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox thinkers and things, I never thought that I would leave the world of Protestantism. And, you know, many things I think were unthinkable. But what surprised me, you know, since then, is how much of a connection that I feel with all Christians. Now, I certainly, like Francis de Sales, I take a side, you know, that I became a Catholic because I thought I should and that other people should. But at the same time, what I think I've been surprised at in certain ways is finding out, you know, how much truth there is out there in many forms. There are lots of people who are wrong, but I find when I look at a lot of these figures, I find that they borrow from many different sources. And that sense that all truth is God's truth really has come clearer to me, even as I remain convicted that the Catholic Church is the one church and things like that. I see the value in basically all Christians, and indeed in many other religious traditions as well. I just think that they come to fulfillment in a different way. But I'm constantly surprised by looking at how much of God's goodness is out there, and that providence puts truth in various places, and how much I need to be able to receive that, and also to then put it into my life so that other people can see that.
Great lessons. Francis de Sales was a patron saint for our age, and your thoughts are also welcome in our conflictual age as well. My guest has been Professor David Deevil. Dave, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.